Hello, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I'm one half of one wannabe games. I'm one half of one of half is what I was going to say, which was not a sentence. I'm one half of wannabe games, and I make tabletop role-playing games, and I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Jess. I am all of Nerdburger Games. I'm Craig Campbell. So I don't have to get quite as tongue twisted as you do. But we, as often is the case, have a guest here, returning guest Sebastian. Hello, welcome aboard again.
Hello, thank you for having me back. I'm Sebastian Yue, my pronouns are they, them. I work full-time at Hit Point Press, but I'm also a writer, designer, and editor of tabletop games.
And thank you for coming back on the show. Always happy to have you here. And I am really excited to talk about this topic because in a couple of the games that I've designed, this is not really a thing that I've done. And we're going to really dig into design today instead of doing also a GMing topic. So mixing things up a little bit, maybe a little bit of a special episode with a special topic about designing special things.
Abilities?
I don't know, Craig, what are we talking about?
We're talking about like special abilities, the things that fall outside of you know, just making strength checks and intelligence checks and, you know, thinking about a basic, you know, attacks and whether your character has health points left or whether they're suffering some sort of condition impediment, but like special abilities, stuff like spellcasting and psionics and cybertech and superpowers and curses and hexes, and just it often is like technologically based or some sort of fantastical thing that many games have integrated into them. In some cases, some games have all of them integrated into them in some form or another. So I thought this is one that's been on the list for a while, and it finally took Sebastian saying, hey, that one looks like that one's calling out to me. Why was it calling out to you?
Honestly, because those are some of my favorite things to do. Like that, like when it comes to designing special abilities, then like that's kind of where I get to be more creative and kind of it's the part of game design that actually gets me really excited, because I'm like, well, this is what's going to draw me in, and this is what's going to draw the other players in, because this is kind of the way that you'll interact with it. And like, if you want to play a character that has a special thing that they can do, then well, here are your options, and I get to make that happen. Like, that's so fun.
Yeah, it's always also my favorite part of playing a game is getting to do like this is what makes my character special. This is the cool thing that I get to do to interact with the world. The special abilities are often also really heavily tied into like the game itself and like the lore of the game or the setting of the game. And that, I don't know, that just makes it really fun to do. It was always my favorite thing of creating a character was deciding, ooh, what am I going to do with my cool abilities? Yeah, but they're hard. I mean, I've designed, I guess, okay. But when I think about a special ability, I think of like the magic, the superhuman stuff. And I've really only designed one game, two maybe, that does that. I wonder like what, you kind of gave a big list, Craig, like what is a special quote unquote ability compared to just an ability?
Well, I think I frame this. I'm the one who put this one on the list, I think, way back in the day, and intended to frame it as it's the stuff that falls outside of what you and I can do in the normal world. Even if we're not very good at it, we could ostensibly do it. Like, I don't really know how to shoot a gun. I'm sure I could do it if I took training and had one in my hand. I could fire at a target. But I wouldn't necessarily be very good at it, but I could reasonably become good at it through practice. But I couldn't cast a fireball. You know, I couldn't. I don't have super strength. I don't have, a neurojack in my head yet. because who knows what the future holds. But I think that it tends to be the thing that I think a lot of players, people looking through the games, you know, picking out a game, it's the thing that excites them about the game, like Sebastian said, because it is something that, well, I can't just imagine myself. I can, you know, I can't do that in real life, but I can imagine this character, this extension of myself doing this cool thing. Like if I'm going to play a supers game, it's because, you know, probably because I want to play a character that can do some super stuff. Because I myself in my real life might have superpowered abilities that are things like, you know, doesn't fall asleep during movies. but I don't necessarily have the ability to read a mind. that's the thing that I think, you know, often sets the special abilities apart in game, and the reason that players latch onto them, and the reason that GMs like to come up with like interesting villains that can do the cool, interesting things to challenge the players, because the GMs get to do that thing too. They get to, you know, project themselves into that villain or that, that other NPC. Mm-hmm. And, but with the idea of special abilities, the you know, among the pitfalls are like, how much is too much? Like you can go to the nth degree. Like there's an upper limit to what the human body can do and what the, you know, what the human mind can do for like making strength checks or trait check or intelligence checks or that sort of thing. But like, how far can magic go? How far can technology go? We don't know what the upper limits on those things are. Some of them are things that don't exist, or maybe don't exist. We don't know. Like a lot of them, there's mysteries, who knows, but there's so much potential, and there's such a power curve and a ramp up, for the types of capabilities that you can have. And that can be tough to design for. So that's one of the things that, you know, we might find ourselves talking about as we're going through this, is like looking at where's our niche within the game world that, you know, where we're designing, like what sorts of special abilities fit, how powerful should they be, and how do I create that to give the players and the GM that experience of using those kind of non-typical things that we can't do in the real world.
Do you find yourself agreeing kind of with what he said, Sebastian, or do you have a different take on what counts as special?
No, I tend to agree. I mean, this is the reason why in, say, like high magic settings, I always will choose to play spellcasters, because, I mean, actually, I'm a former competitive fencer, so I already know how to stab people. Like, I don't, you know, like that's already a skill I have. Why would I?
I always forget how cool you are. that's so cool.
yeah, but honestly, it's just, but I like the idea of imagining myself doing this thing that I can't do in real life, whereas I could, in fact, pick up a sword and stab someone legally in real life, so... Yeah,
in a controlled environment, everybody.
In a controlled environment where the whole purpose is to in fact stab someone, yes, but also but just, you know. Yeah. But so yeah, like that part definitely resonated with me, and I was thinking like in terms of a player facing perspective, then yeah, like if you're going to be designing these abilities, then like, you know, you want every class or every playbook or every kind of character archetype to have a thing that it can do, and like, you know, there tends to be a theme, especially, so like kind of how do we come up with these abilities and make them feel cohesive, make them feel unique, and also make sure that they work with the core mechanics of the game, because when you say that it's something that is beyond the bounds of ordinary ability, like that makes sense to me. But also I think in terms of like design, it should be beyond the mechanics that are the base mechanics that are established. So it has that kind of twofold aspect to it.
Yeah, that really resonates with me, because when I was designing the Means of Magic, we have, there's magic in the game. And it became very clear that we needed something a little different to handle that. Whereas all the other abilities can be very heavily negotiated at the table. And that's kind of the point of the game. Like as you're designing your character, you're working with other people, you're working with like, what are your characters doing, and picking out your skills and deciding how that actually works in context. We couldn't let that happen with magic, because it would just go, like it could go easily off the rails. So we had to kind of limit, we had to really like set some not super strict limits. The game is not very super strict, but set some limits about what the magic can do, what it can't do, what the skills you're using to build your magic is or an are. And even though the core mechanic was relatively similar in that you're always increasing to a certain level, and if you hit that level, something happens, it needed it just needed a little bit of extra. It is the special thing in our game. And at first I was kind of like I didn't want to do it like that. I wanted it to fit in with the rest of how we built the skills, and I wanted it to be this open negotiation at the table, like this quick negotiation, where we're really focused on like making something cool and cinematic, for lack of a better word, for the players. It just wasn't tenable when it came down to it. And I'm glad we didn't end up like leaving it completely unlimited, because I mean, Craig, you even said it, like, how much is too much? You, even though I think my personal opinion, balance is a little overrated in games. You don't always need to be incredibly balanced, but you do need some balance. You can't have it in order to have fun at the table, unless the game is specifically about being completely imbalanced. There needs to be every character needs its own chance to feel special and like it's doing something in the game. That's tough when you're building these special abilities. I mean, it's even tough in comic books when you do have the complete creative line, right? Like, no one wants to dress up as Toad, but everyone wants to dress up as Rogue, right? In X-Men. Well, I'm sure that there are some big Toad fans. I'm gonna stop talking now
because you just drove away all the Toad fans.
The X-Men people angry.
But that's true. But even so, as a designer, even if you're okay with there being upper, you know, like super powerful and getting really big, and you're not as concerned about whether it's power balanced, like you said, we've had the discussion many times about like if the fun and the engagement is balanced and everybody has a chance to, you know, enjoy the characters and the abilities in their own way, then that's fine. Like somebody, or, you know, bigger damage output character than another character, that's fine. But as a designer, you do need to at least be aware of where those limitations, you know, where your limits are, how you're setting them, and how you're utilizing them in the game, and whether they're available to all characters or to only certain types of characters. That gets to be kind of a weird thing to deal with, because like using D&D as an example, we know that spellcasting goes up to 9th level. It gets very, very, very powerful, to the extent of characters that are raining fire like meteor showers and are making wishes where they can basically make anything happen, to like a fighter has special abilities. They get more and more kind of over the top combat capabilities that start to bend the laws of physics, but not nearly to the level that arcane spellcasters do, and really divine spellcasters for that matter as well. So it's one of those things that I think is worth having as a designer, having it in your head where your special abilities and, you know, where your, how it's going to fit and how it's going to work in your game, so that you know where the upper limit is. Like, for example, when I designed Capers, which is a superpowers game, I set it to be sort of like street level superpower. So we never get super powerful. And then even to the point of, I made a conscious decision at the beginning where I said, there's not going to be any sort of Professor X level mind control. There's not a power in any of the supplements or anything that does that. There's not going to be any sort of Magneto level magnetics control, because those two characters are super duper powerful in the X-Men universe because of the powers that they have. And they're like, they're well above, let's say, Toad. just the fact.
Continuing the Toad slander.
No, Toad can be, I'm sure people can play a Toad-like character and have a great deal of fun. But, you know, there's an upper limit. There was things I decided I'm not going to do this. Like, and if you're dealing with superpower stuff, maybe you don't want to go down that route, because I made the choice because for the purposes of a storytelling in a comic, it's fine to have Magneto come in and do stuff that really blows everybody away. But in the game, I didn't want to give players abilities that would just solve every problem. Like being able to mind control anybody to the level of literally dictating what an entire city's worth of people will do, that just solves every problem. Like the other characters won't get a chance to shine, because that mind control character is just going to solve everything. And then if you put the ability in there, well, it's like, well, we'll include ways to circumnavigate that. Like Magneto has his helmet so that he can't be mind controlled by Professor X,
yeah.
Which is fine narratively, because then you can have him not have that helmet every so often and raise the stakes for him as a character. But in game, not so great to have to be constantly nerfing things in order to make things, because then the person who has the cool ability feels like they're getting constantly limited, and the other characters, if that player isn't getting constantly limited, then the other characters feel like, well, why am I even here?
Yeah. Honestly, I really like that you brought all of that up. Like, first, because you did mention arcane casters in D&D, and that is my favorite class to play. And I also really love that that you discussed, like, that you established, like, your upper limit, because recently, like, with the new 2024 rules, like, they didn't put all of the subclasses in the player's handbook, and so I was part of a design team that did a community project to write, like, the rest of the subclasses and update them for 2024. And if you remember, like, last time we talked about time travel, I'm a huge fan of it. So mm-hmm. I did a Chronomancer Wizard. And because Explorer's Guide to Wildemount has the Chronogist, and that's technically, like, that isn't SRD, like, that's not a thing that I can do even on the DM's Guild. I got the chance to do my own take on it. And so I was thinking in terms of, you know, risk and reward. So I am a huge fan of, like, really powerful abilities, but I think it's interesting when they come at a cost. And so for the kind of, for the 14th level ability that I designed, I made it so this wizard can create a time loop. And for that, it means that you can choose a spell that you have prepared and just kind of cast it for 6 rounds. And you have to keep doing it. That's the only action that you can do, like, on your turn. But you can do it without expending spell slots. And then when the effect ends, you get an exhaustion level for each level of the chosen spell. And so that sounds really powerful, but it also kind of soft caps it at fifth level if you don't want to die. But if you want to die and you want to kill your character and, like, go out doing this, then that's the choice you can make. And I thought it was really narratively interesting to kind of offer that possibility.
Thinking like that requires a lot of creativity. Where can us designers, like, how do we do something like that? Because that is, like, unique. That's different than, like, a lot of, I was taking notes while you were saying it, because it's very, very fascinating to me. Where do we get these ideas so they are, number one, work in the game, work with the mechanics, but also are unique in a way that other people haven't seen before? So you're not just, like, rehashing the same, you're a wizard, you're a cleric kind of idea over and over again, because it's been done. It's not that it's not fun, but it's been done.
Yeah, I mean, for me, for making this, for this subclass, honestly, once I kind of got it out of my brain that I was adapting the source material and that I was making my own thing, that I found to be very helpful. And I can see that, like, where the source material was trying to balance it, like, their Chronogy Wizard is very much about, like, you can rewind time a little bit, you can re-roll this, you can change it. And so, like, keeping the limit to what you can alter to be within, like, you know, the last roll you made kind of thing, like, that's their way of balancing that. And I was thinking, but I was like, well, if I'm a time wizard, then what kinds of things would I like to be able to do, and what kinds of, you know, temporal phenomena would I be likely to encounter? And so I just wrote down a list of, like, things that are associated with time travel, because I really wanted that to be the theme, and for every ability to kind of tie back to that. And so I was like, you know, okay, like, what we talked about doppelgangers, we talked about time loops, we talked about alternate timelines, like, and then I had these kind of keywords out, and I thought about the mechanics, and I was like, well, what mechanics exist that would allow me to play with these things? And I was like, well, I mean, there are ways for other classes to take different spells from other spell lists. And so maybe if I reflavor that as, like, I don't know, maybe you've done a lot of time travel, and maybe you've met a past version of yourself, or, like, a different timeline version of yourself that has a different spell, then maybe that is a way for you to choose spells from other people's class lists. And also, like, you know, like the College of Lore Bard gets that at sixth level, and then bards get magical secrets, and so it's not unheard of. And so if you know the game that you're designing for, and you know what's possible, and you kind of combine that with the theme that you're really interested in, then I think that works really well. And also, if you are designing your own game, then there's no reason why you can't just put it in because you want to.
Yeah,
like, yeah, just kind of, you know, like free yourself to just do the thing that is really cool and fun, and go from there. Like,
absolutely. And that's such a good way to keep it thematic too. At the same, I love the idea that you have, like, I'm imagining a cork board Doppelganger.
Yeah, and, no, I did. I had that, and you know, like, and there's a lot of, you know, like there's a lot of, well, the number six, and there's a lot of the number 12 because, well, time is base 12, and so I'm just going to put that in there. So, like, you know, that's why I picked six rounds, and like, I have one, like, this wizard has an ability where, you know, they can kind of twist time and accelerate the decay of organic matter, and so like that translates to, well, when you cast a wizard spell and you deal damage with it, then you get an extra six necrotic damage, but when you keep doing it, like every subsequent turn, that damage decreases by one. So it's kind of like a kind of countdown thing. So you'll do six damage, then you'll do five damage, and then it'll decay in that way. And so like it kind of incentivizes you to finish the fight quickly to not run out of this extra necrotic damage. And I like the idea that you're messing with time to that extent. So like there's a lot of things you can do with it. And I honestly, I had a lot of fun, and I really hope that people actually do play this. It's in the supplement, subclass is Revivified, so.
Okay, so you everyone hear that?
Subclasses Revivified. Play Micronomancer, please.
There's the key right there. You have to design abilities that you would also want to play, because that's going to bring the most life to your characters. That was the whole reason I did Means of Magic too. I really like the idea of playing with ley lines and doing like cool elemental magic stuff, and I think that like it helps us come up with some really good ideas for our magic characters, even if coming up with the actual mechanics for it ended up being not a huge hassle, but it was just something we had to extra think about.
And yeah, I think so. And sorry, go ahead.
No.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think so. And I also think that, like, you know, not every ability has to be some kind of like groundbreaking, earth-shaking, like phenomenally original thing that has never been done before. Sometimes you can make characters feel unique by making them better at the thing that they're supposed to do. So I mean, I have like one of the more mundane abilities for this one was I just let you kind of add the haste and slow spells to your spell book for free if you don't already have them. And then, you know, I just said, well, you always have them prepared, and you have advantage on con saves that you make to maintain concentration on them. And I was like, well, I mean, if you're a time wizard, it kind of makes sense that you're really good at those ones. So that's not maybe the most mechanically original idea, but it's useful, and it doesn't, you know, it does incentivize you to use those spells, and it does show that actually, like, it does show the character's expertise in this matter. So there are lots of different ways to make these abilities feel special.
And all that is working within a rule system that, yeah, I mean, if you're creating content for D&D, you kind of have to follow their mechanics and their general idea of how things work. I'm not a huge D&D player, but I know a lot of people get a little up in arms about making sure that things fit and that they are balanced. And even with all of that, having something that can be really cool, really unique, even within this very, very popular franchise. Good job. Kudos to you.
Thank you. It was super fun. I had a lot of fun designing that.
Craig, what you were talking about earlier with the types of powers that you wouldn't have in your game, I'm wondering if that is a good way to kind of create that limit for yourself too. And I wonder also, Sebastian, you can comment on that too. Were there limits that you decided couldn't happen with the powers? And how does that help us, like, kind of create the box for ourselves if we don't want to spread out infinitely? We don't want to create a god character, like kind of creating those boxes for ourselves. How do we go about doing that, I guess, is my real question.
How do you establish those limits?
Yeah,
like
the boundaries and the limits.
Right. Yeah. I think about it in the context of like the larger context of playing the game. So when I'm thinking about making an ability cool, I'm mainly thinking about the player who is going to be playing with that. And as long as everything else in the game is equally as cool, then that's fine. But I've also got to consider like what the impact is going to have on the GM, if there is one, and on the other players. And so for that reason, I didn't kind of codify you can actually time travel in this game. Because if I introduce that for this class, then that might be a problem for the DM, who now suddenly has to figure out actually like how am I going to deal with causality, and how am I going to kind of reconcile all of the issues that are introduced by time travel if I have this one player who really wants to do it, but now I'm not really prepared to do that. So I said to myself, well, I'm not going to make this class do time travel in the present, like in the sense that in the sense I'm not going to give them a spell that lets them move timelines like well like in the fiction, because that would just cause problems for the GM and maybe for the other players at the table if that happens without prior discussion. So that was a limit. But there's still ways to kind of build it in, and if there was a player who wanted to do that, then the class is kind of set up in a way that they could raise it as a conversation first. So I think about the impact on the story and also on the gameplay and how practical it would be for everybody to implement it.
I've also seen several times where in games with a lot of special abilities, where in a GM section it'll say, yes, the players are limited in this way. You're a GM. You can kind of do what you would like to because that's your world that you're now playing in. And even having a little caveat like that can still let you kind of give the GMs and even the players to some extent the ability to stretch out a little bit more from like being concerned about, oh, this is what the rules say, and I can't go beyond that, which is always my least favorite thing about playing a game. I want to be creative. I want to make the world cool. I don't want these words on a page, these nerds who wrote this stuff on the page telling me what to do. So this is just tough. I Moonpunk has no special abilities. We're just on the moon and punching people.
One of the things that I've run into with dealing with, particularly with like the more powerful abilities, is incorporating how those things are limited in some way. D&D does that inherently just by when it comes to like spell casting by having limited spell slots. And so if the characters don't get the chance to rest often enough to regain the ability to cast spells, they're only going to use it so much. And the GM can plan and know, okay, I've got characters that are casting at this is their highest level of spell. They've all only got one, at this point. They're high enough level to have one spell at that level. So they can blow that ability and do that awesome cool thing. And now I can, as a GM, like now I can create a, I can ramp up the challenge or have another challenge come up that's going to make them have to work a little harder to do stuff with lower level abilities. And so, you can build it in like D&D does with just like levels of everything. I've done it a few different ways in games of mine where in Good Strong Hands, all the characters have these talents. You have a bunch of different playbooks, and they all have like seven or eight talents, and every talent is unique to that playbook. So you're the only person who can do that thing. And if you have a party of characters that are all playing different playbooks, they're all going to have unique abilities. Nobody's going to be stepping on each other's toes. And then they also have three corruptions, which are the extra powerful abilities, which include things like just straight up killing, a character or otherwise removing them from play, like permanently. Like the fawn character playbook can you can they don't kill a character, but they can cause somebody to dance forever. Okay, so that person is no longer a threat. They're just off dancing forever.
That's hilarious.
But it's expense, it's a corruption. So in order to get it in the first place, you have to start down this road of corruption, which can destroy your character in the process, because if you get too many corruptions and then you fill up this shadow track again, like your character falls to the void and becomes, an NPC, basically becomes a scion of the void and becomes an enemy. And the corruptions are built that whenever you use a corruption, you mark a shadow, or in some cases of the really, really deadly stuff, you mark two shadow, and occasionally you mark a permanent shadow. If you do something, there's like one of the playbooks has a wish type ability, and you mark a permanent shadow. So that box on that track gets filled permanently. You can only wish so many times. So the corruptions become a death spiral. Like the more you use them, it's going to lead you closer and closer to losing your character. So it creates a meta game for the player to engage in. Like, how fast do I want to let my character spiral? Because I can get these cool abilities that will solve problems for us. But the more I do it, the faster the faster I can potentially lose my character. And then the game itself has, because you've got these tracks of checks boxes that you're filling up for the game itself, there's what's referred to as the complexity dial, which is you set it as a group. You decide how long each of those tracks is going to be. So you could take that shadow track and make it very short. So instead of being 10 boxes long, it's 6 boxes long. So characters are going to fill out that track faster. They're going to get corruptions faster. They're going to risk their character falling to the void faster. And that creates a very different dynamic to the game, still allows the abilities to be used. And it's the player's choice if they want to say, okay, my character is going to just like have this. He's going to save a bunch of lives. He's going to do a bunch of stuff fighting the void. And then he's going to fall because that's the narrative. That's the story that I want to play with this character. So thinking about how all of that fits into the world, into the game, into the stories that you're telling, and what that means for the GM. Because like if I were to run a campaign of Good Strong Hands, I could set that corruption. We could talk and everybody would decide we're going to set that shadow track very short. And I'll pay very close attention to how fast, you know, if I see a player that's really starting to burn through gaining shadow and they're getting corruptions quickly and everything, I'll give them all the opportunities I can to use more and tempt them, because that's what the void does in the game. The void tempts you toward darkness. And the corruptions are actually representative of that. So, and that's thematic to the game. And we were talking about like how you can burn all of this stuff into being thematic to the game in some way. In another game, I'm doing a thing where everything, it's got the similar tracks that you're marking off on. And everything about that track is building you toward using your cool ass ability. But there's no downside to it because you're basically a superhero. So you've got these Nova abilities. They're actually called Novas in the game because it's a sci-fi game. And you're building toward that. But everything else you do, like I've got more of this point, so I eventually get a reroll. I've got more of this point, so I actually can roll more dice to get more successes. And if I get a lot of successes, then I mark on this track and I eventually get to like split myself in half and have two attacks. And then when I recombine, I heal because that's my super cool ability.
Yeah. I mean, I think for some games, it doesn't matter. Like for some games, the point is you are doing all the cool things. You're doing all the cool things forever because you're really cool. And that's the whole point of the game. And then there are other games where the point is to like venture into what does it mean to have this power and to be able to do these cool things compared to the people who don't have the power. And again, that's just like playing into the thematic nature of your own game. I always personally, I like to read stories where, you know, magic is a metaphor for something. And once you figure out what magic is a metaphor for, you can, or your special abilities, what are the superpowers a metaphor for, and start to draw out to what are the conclusions then? What are the logical conclusions for you if you're building a character or a game system that uses these abilities? That's something a GM can also do a little bit, because GMs are designers in many of their own ways. Some of the coolest stuff I've ever seen done at a table has been completely written in by a GM, because they are also game designers. But like as a designer, really thinking, I think like you really, especially as an indie game designer, where we stand out the best is really making sure that we are being on brand and thematic. Considering that and then working your mechanics to make sure that all of that makes sense. Like with good strong hands, Craig, like the point is this corruption, like, you know, that's the point of that game. Whereas in, I'm assuming your Supers game, the point is saving the world and being cool and being kick-ass.
It's defeating the evil galactic empire. And the best way to do that is to go in as powered up as possible when you're taking on the baddie. So it, you know, and even in the game too, it because you need to fill up the ability to use these Novas, like it encourages the group to go like, we'll go and have a little skirmish fight over here, and we'll go run a heist over here, and we'll go rescue somebody over here, and we'll do these smaller things and where I won't probably have to use a Nova, and I'll build up the ability to use that so I can save those things up and I can have maximum Nova superpower potential when I've got to go take on, like, you know, the destroyer fleet.
And I mean, in a game like D&D, like if you're playing the Chronomancer, that kind of idea is more or less up to the GM. Like, okay, you're playing with time. How do the gods feel about that? Maybe things will go wrong in that area. because in a game like D&D, so much of it is like you know, people tell all sorts of stories using D&D. So just very I love the possibilities of directions. Yeah. What about making sure, because we've talked about making sure that our characters are unique from each other. What are some tips and tricks to ensuring that all these people doing magic are using their magical flavor in different ways and not just with different flavors or different colors assigned to them?
Right. I mean, I find that with D&D, like that, I find that to be easier than with other systems because it is like the way that their magic system works, like they split it up into very distinct schools of magic and each school does a specific thing. And so to me, like that kind of gives it, that already sets very clear parameters between like the different kinds of magic that you can do. And like, I like the way that's set up. Like, you know, there's a subclass for every kind of school of magic that you have. But I do find that one of the most challenging things for designing, like, for instance, like, I don't know, for Powered by the Apocalypse games, I find that my biggest challenge is looking at the other playbooks and making sure that mine does not do the same thing that they do in theirs. And I did have, like, sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm going to do this and it sounds really cool. And wait, I need to check the other playbooks and see that none of them do that. Some of them do that. And I'm like, okay, well, I either need to pick a different ability altogether, or I can finesse it and reflavor it to make it feel different. Like, that is an option. And I think that, like, mechanically, it can do something similar, but if it's flavored and narratively different, then I think that in the fiction, in the game, it can still come across as being your own unique thing, even if it mechanically does a similar thing. And I think I think that approach works a bit more for Powered by the Apocalypse games in my experience anyway.
Yeah, with Powered by the Apocalypse, you can play around with things like, what are the consequences of that, like, the you could have the same move, but the consequences are different, or the trigger to do the move is different. But it is like the whole point of having the playbooks is so that no one is doing the same thing. And that is the challenge of designing those types of games. And then there are some playbooks that could take moves from other playbooks, and that provides its own challenge.
I do like, for Powered by the Apocalypse, the way that you can take moves from other playbooks, but your starting move is always yours and nobody else can take that. And I find that the starting move is the core of the playbook at every kind of PBTA playbook. And I think that's a really good design decision, because it allows you a lot of creativity, but also at the end of the day, like, your playbook is like that ability, like it's always going to kind of come back to that one. And I like that a lot.
Yeah, it's one of the things that makes that type of system unique. Whereas for like D&D, your starting moves are, I mean, yes, there's a lot of variety within them, but by the time they get to whatever level, pretty much you can do something equivalent to that starting move, no matter what class you're in.
And there's multi-class rules.
Yeah, multi-class.
You
know,
so
rules.
Then you dip in, and what's the first thing you get? Like the core ability of the other class,
right?
But you give something up in the process, so there's a balance to it. There's a loss. Yeah.
And I do find that with Powered by the Apocalypse, when things aren't, when, like, because you get to choose from a selection of moves, and none of them are necessarily more powerful unless we're playing with that kind of corruption, or with the, you know, for Apocalypse Keys, it's like, you know, you mark ruin. And so that kind of demonstrates, like, how much of a harbinger are you willing to become to use this move? So it's a kind of similar kind of premise. So there, but when you have a selection of moves and, like, you can take them, I don't, It takes the power kind of out of the equation, and then you think of actually, like, what vibe do I want, and like how will I feel when I use this move, and how am I going to take this move and make it my own for this character. And I think that's also an interesting and worthwhile question to ask, because you know, like the move being unique to your character is one thing, but also, like, if it's not necessarily more powerful on paper than any of the other options that you could have taken. I think that you choosing to do that and then being excited about doing that is that's kind of like a player driven thing. Like they'll choose a move that they're excited about and manifest it in that way, in the way that they want.
Yeah. I have been this player before. I understand that. I think also, like, as a designer, thinking about the kinds of stories that you are wanting, like, imagine, like, making sure that you can imagine them using this move in a situation. And if you can't imagine a situation where that would be useful or fun, which are not always the same thing and can be at different different times, if you can't imagine that, maybe think about why you've included it in the first place and maybe get rid of it, self-edit, or ask in your playtest group, which is going to be my next question, ask in your playtest group to try to use it, try to figure out if you can use it in the game and see how they do. So my question was, now, how do we go about playtesting our special moves? What strategies do we have to do that might be different from the rest of the regular abilities in your game to test our special abilities?
Go ahead.
I think one of the first things that I run into, and it's because, and this informs kind of like how I've done special abilities in the games, is if there's a power level increase in the game, like D&D has a power level. You start at first level, you can't take on 15th level creatures until you get higher level, right? So because there's that incremental leveling up of having more hit points, of being able to do output and so forth, you really have to play test as many of those levels as you can. You need to see how the low level stuff works. You got to kind of work through all the different levels. It's a much more intensive process, I would imagine, when it comes to play testing. Special abilities in many of my games turn more on not so much a power level increase that takes place as your character advances, but a versatility that takes place. So you gain more abilities that allow you to do more things. So that cool ability you took at first level is still that same cool ability at eighth level, but now you've got three times as many abilities. Ideally you've played from first level up to that point, so you've learned how all of them work as you go, and you're not dealing with analysis paralysis every time you've got like this big list of abilities to choose from. I Now that I think about it too, that would probably behoove people who are playtesting in level-based stuff. Actually, in general, is to start them at the lower levels, have them play test that, and build slowly, and have the same groups play testing, right? So that they're learning the new stuff as they go, so that when they get at higher level, like, okay, now I'm play testing these new, or I've got more abilities, or I've got more powerful abilities that I'm trying out. I'm going to see how those work. I understand all these other ones that I've already played through, so when I'm playing the game, I'm not going to make the mistake of not understanding how these five abilities work. I can pay attention to, I've got those figured out. I'm going to pay attention to these three new ones and really kind of focus on them. And I'm going to put my critical mind toward that. If you give a group of playtesters, this happened once. I playtested during the Player's Handbook 3 of fourth edition. And we were kind of late in the playtesting group, and we were given like 16th level character. We were to make 16th level characters. For fourth edition. Now, fourth edition was already out, so we had played the game, but we're making 16th level characters with all those, at will encounter and daily abilities, and we were slow as hell doing it. We were making mistakes with it because we had so many abilities that we were trying to work from. That would have been a much better playtesting experience if we had been able to play test five or six sessions of progression up through the levels. We had a hard time offering reasonable, helpful feedback. So yeah, that I think that's the first thing I look at is like, what do all those abilities do? What needs to be tested? Progression, versatility, all that sort of thing, and try to make the playtest accommodate doing that without putting any more burden on the playtesters, as you absolutely have to.
Yeah, I think for me, like going back to the like viewing the game as like a kind of holistic thing, I think it's really important to when you get a group together to do play testing, to ask the players how they felt about the other players' special abilities as well. Like was it fun for you to see this player do this? Do you feel like your ability was of that you also got an equally cool moment? Like, did you enjoy like the way that the group worked together and do these abilities work? It work together, and is there, like, you know, are you able to collaborate on the story in the same kind of way, in a way that is fun and narratively satisfying? Like asking that, like those kinds of questions are interesting because, I mean, I have heard feedback, that you know, like sometimes, I don't know, like if you play a different character class and like the core of your kind of, or a playbook and the core of someone else's character playbook is. Makes it very difficult for you to play. It was like maybe you're playing a character that is kind of reckless and has no sense of self-preservation, but they're playing a character who is very like overprotective and wants everyone to survive and get through this. And then, but then it's like they're kind of the core of their character is preventing your character from doing the kind of reckless stuff that you want to do. Then that, you know, that might be a problem. Like I understand how that's a problem. So. Like getting the impression not just of the player who is playing the special ability, but getting everyone's input is something I would like to consider for for that.
Yeah, if the whole point is making sure that it feels good for everybody at the table, asking the other players, that's key. How did you feel about there? Okay, you weren't a Jedi. How do you feel about the Jedi being here at the table? But also, I mean, we didn't really talk about this, but because we were focused on like the special abilities, but making sure the non-special abilities are just as fun. And can be used in just as cool of a way to make sure that even the non-special ability players have their moment to shine too. I mean, Han Solo isn't a Jedi, but everyone likes him more than Luke. In my opinion, he's cooler. For me, a lot of the playtesting was revolving around the mechanics of it. Does it work mechanically compared to everything else? Because as we said at the beginning, it's kind of its own system. It's a slightly modified version of this of the core system that you have when you're doing magic or you're doing these special abilities, and making sure that that works in a way that is not distracting from the rest of the game and is not bogging down the game and slowing it down because of all these dice you're rolling or all these cards you're flipping or all the checks you're checking off, making sure that all that works in a smooth manner, just logistically at the table, I think is also very important, especially if your game is loaded up with a bunch of different, if your special abilities each are basically their own rule, making sure that that's not heavy. It can be crunchy, but not heavy. I think heaviness kind of ruins the game.
Yeah. I mean, I think it has to be on a level that is it is a reasonable kind of cognitive lift to understand what is happening, but it can still be crunchy in the sense that there's numbers and things to think about.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Hopefully, while people are doing the numbers and the crunchiness, they're still thinking about how cool this thing is that they're about to do or that they've just done. Because that's the goal. As long as they're happy with the math that they're
Yeah,
doing.
I think that's what designers would call elegant game design or something.
Oh yeah, you know. Do we have any final thoughts about special abilities? Any special thoughts about special abilities?
one of the things that I'm running into with like these with the thing I'm designing right now, which has like these, you know, Nova abilities, these very, very powerful, is looking at like, okay, there's going to be combat abilities. Combat Novas, and then there's going to be non-combat ones. And even for the lower, the lesser powered ones too, there's going to be ones that are combat oriented, ones that aren't. And making sure that the ones that aren't combat based are like you were both talking about, is like they're fun and flavorful and interesting and engaging, to the point of like most players, or many players at least, will look at the list and be like, these are actually some tough choices. Like, there's some cool combat stuff, but I can do combat. I can't do this thing, this other thing. You know, is it worth spending my limited number of points to purchase this thing? Like I had it come up in a playtest recently, which was there's an ability for and it's the particular ability is themed for a character type that isn't, you know, tends to be an outsider, kind of alone. They're like one of many. They fade into the crowd, sort of thing, right? And so it's the ability is called Minute Presence, which is if you only move so fast and you don't act directly against anybody, that is, you don't attack them, nobody notices you. You're not invisible. Camera still sees you. Everybody else, your friends, know where you are, but nobody pays attention to what you're doing, like your enemies and everything. So and it's an interesting idea. I thought it's like, okay, it's not invisibility, so it's not like treading on that particular thing. And it's not limited by like spending points and whatnot. It's like, if I just decide to take my turn and not do a lot, like people kind of don't worry about me. Nobody pointed it out, but I'm sure there will be people who read it and see it. I modeled the idea off of Drax in Guardians of the Galaxy with his supposed ability to remain so motionless and moving so slowly that nobody sees me, that I turn invisible. Like he doesn't move and he's eating a Zargnut bar or whatever it's called. And he's like, but I'm moving so incredibly slowly. And it's a comedic moment, but I'm like, you know, like with them channeling the power of the universe, like it's the idea that like, there might be something that's, you know, like moving over there. There's something that's happening over there, but it's going so slowly. It's not catching your attention like the rest of this combat where everything's really moving.
Well, you should have done the Mystery Men where so no one's looking at you. You're invisible.
As long as you're not wearing clothing, you have to be nude, right?
Yes.
Like Invisible Boy. such an underappreciated movie. I love that movie. To the point that I actually made a supplement for Capers called Not So Superpowers, which is all of their abilities.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Caper abilities. It's a PDF on DriveThruRPG. Yes. So you can be the shoveler.
Great.
Or the Blue Raja. I think that's something that to think about quite a bit too, is when you have those abilities, even if they're kind of low key, if they can be really interesting and thematically kind of nuanced and be like, people go, oh, that's just kind of neat. Mm-hmm. That can be really cool too, even if like when put up against an ability that like does like some cool damage that you normally can't do with just a normal, you know, laser pistol attack.
Sebastian, any final thoughts from you?
I don't think so. I think I managed to say all of the things that I really wanted to say about this. But yeah, like I'm like, again, it's my favorite thing to do is to design like unique abilities, especially if they're player facing, because it makes me really happy to know that this very specific thing will appeal to someone. And like, I think that's also part of it to me. It's that like, make it really specific, like do it, like have a playbook or a class that does one specific thing really, really well. I think that's kind of like, if you do that, then you'll be great.
Well, excellent. Thank you, Sebastian, for coming on to the show again. Where can we find you and your stuff?
Yeah, thank you for having me again. It's always a great time. You can find me everywhere at Sebastian Yue, so SebastianYue. And my website is sebastianyue.ca because I'm based in Canada.
Ooh, Canada.
Yeah, Canada.
I am found on the internet at Joska or Jess is awful, or at wannabegames.com. You can find all those there. DriveThruRPG and Itch under Wannabe Games.
I'm at Nerdburger Craig on various social medias. My website is nerdburgergames.com. If you're listening to this in the next few weeks here from when we're recording early October, it might be down for a little while because it's going to get a redesign. Woohoo!
Ooh, that's so exciting.
It will be under construction for a time. But you can always go to drivethruhrpg.com as well.
My website's been under construction as not necessarily a bit, but partially as a bit for 2 years. Thank you to our opening and closing theme song, which is Avail by Stefsex. I was going to try not to say that this time and actually say it in a way that made sense. Sorry, I'm ruining your bingo boards. is what I wanted to do. Thank you to our opening and closing theme song by Avel, which is Avel by Steph Sachs, licensed under Creative Commons. Thank you, Steph Sachs. And thank all of you for listening. And we'll see you back here next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.